really a treat for me to have you in, because I have purchased all of your books over the years, including Hall of Mirrors and Dog Soldiers, and so I'm pretty well up on your stuff, and I this was a great opportunity for me to be able to talk to a writer that I've admired for many years. I really appreciate your taking the time out to come in. I know that this probably in a very busy period for you. You've had a lot of interviews and things, haven't you?
Well, I have. I just got back also the Tuesday from New Zealand. I was down in Australia, New Zealand, and on the at the Adelaide and the Wellington Book Fair. So I was pretty spacey Tuesday when I arrived, and I'm about to go into the vortex of this, you know, a series of interviews and things. So I will really have to walk slow and drink a lot of water, as Kesey said of himself when he was about to go to jail.
Well, as William Kennedy told me, he's been in a couple of times talking about his books. He says, when a book comes out, you have to give it its due. Because he says, if you don't do it, nobody else will.
Right. Well, that's absolutely true. And if you're trying to get your stuff out there and in front of people, if you believe in what you say, you want to get as many people to hear it said.
I get this little paper, a little four-page sheet. I think it's called Book Selling. And it was saying that Michener's book, Texas, came out recently. And Michener, I think, did one appearance on the Today Show. And that was it. I understand that Michener had been in the hospital and had some heart surgery done in Austin. But the upshot was that I think Random House published 150,000 copies, first printing of that book. And the book, for some reason, had made the list, but it didn't do very well. And this little sheet, a little scandal sheet, said that his publisher thought it was directly attributable to the fact that Michener didn't get behind the book and do any publicity on it.
Huh. I would have thought Michener was on automatic.
Yeah.
You have a Michener book, and a Michener book, that's it.
People have to know about it.
But it's amazing to hear that a guy in Michener's position has got to hustle a little. I mean, to get his book where you would think his book where it normally is.
Well, he doesn't have to hustle the way most people have to hustle, but right. Still, people have to know about it, and they have to get interested in it. And so there's no other, publishers are not going to take out a big advertising budget. They may for Michener to a degree, or to a Ludlum, books that they can count on selling 100,000 copies and have a huge paperback rights, but with the average book. I've also reached the conclusion that a book sometimes will come on the bestseller list. Like a week before it comes out. And I was thinking about that. I mean, a week before it's the actual pub date, you'll see a certain books, like a Ludlum book, on the bestseller list. And I was thinking, how can that be? I mean, nobody knows about the book yet. I mean, how could people flock to the stores to buy it? And then I began to realize that the bestseller list doesn't mean very much in terms of sales. For example, if no book is selling in a given period, it will still make a bestseller list because that happens to be selling more than any other books at the time, but the sales may be extremely modest. So the bestseller list doesn't mean very much.
That was only pointed out to me fairly recently. I never knew that. I thought that automatically meant that millions and millions of copies were being sold, but of course that's right. It doesn't mean that much.
You know, I found out that a year ago, John Updike, for all his prestige and his many books, was only on the bestseller list once, and that was with his last book, which was called The Witches of
Witches Ipswich. Ipswich or something like that.
And he came in for an interview and talked to me, and we were talking about that, and I was stunned. I would have thought that all of his rabbit books would have been on there. And
I would have, too. I would have, too.
So, but anyway, these things, I've been watching writers and publishing and the book business for a number of years, but it takes a long, but I have never worked in it, so it takes a long time for these things to dawn on me, just as a reporter, and to realize that things aren't always what they seem.
If you had asked me, I would have thought that the Updike was on the bestseller list with every book since Couples. That would have been my guess.
Yeah. Well, what I thought we would do... Before we get into the bulk of the interview, tell me a little bit about New Zealand. You say there was a book fair there?
Yeah, there was a book fair in Wellington, it was called Readers and Writers Week. It was part of the Wellington Festival. And there was also Writers Week as part of the Adelaide Festival, which is a biannual, once every 2 years, thing that the city of Adelaide, Australia does. And in addition to going to those festivals, I was also in various other cities, Perth and Sydney, whatnot, giving readings, giving lectures. My tour sponsored partly by USIS, which, as they are known abroad, or USIA, as they are known at home. Mm-hmm. So I've really been moving around a lot, and I've been spread out over a whole lot of, over many time zones. So I'm slightly spacey. I mean, I only got in Tuesday.
Mm.
But,
so your jet lag has not, well, relax.
I landed talking. I mean, I left talking, and I landed, I got off the plane talking.
Well, relax, because I don't do a Mike Wallace, my job, as I see it, is to celebrate the book and the word, and not to do a number on it. So what I try to do is make the art and the profession look as good as I can, because I think it, to me it's a commitment. I don't mind saying that on the air, that I think it's a commitment and something to do. If there is a book I don't like, rather than get on the air and trash it, I just don't do it. It's not worth it. Besides, I also have the feeling that I know for a fact that no matter if the book isn't up to par, the writer has usually put himself into it. Sometimes a book that's not up to par still may have been the book that the writer worked the hardest on, putting his soul and his tears and effort
that's
in
right.
it. And I see no reason to denigrate that. I see a lot of cheap criticism that I don't think is always appropriate or necessary.
No, well, one of the problems, criticism, is that it is so much, you're so much more readable to write put-downs, to be dismissive. I mean, you can be witty. It's possible for a critic to display, all their wit and dark insights and so forth, whereas it's less readable to praise. I mean, it's a lot easier to put something down because you can be funny. You can show what a hot ticket you are by putting something down, and whereas celebrating something is a lot harder.
Also, in almost every book that I read, I see flaws in it. But they're not... These are things that I tend to just overlook. It's like filling in a missed letter in a word, a mischaracter in a word, or a missing word in a sentence. You tend to do that and not even pay attention. And I tend to... I mean, if it's a persistent awkwardness... this might be annoying and worth calling to the writer's attention in a positive way.
Yeah, yeah.
But back to New Zealand. Is your book being distributed there now and in Australia?
It's not. It's supposed to be being distributed there, and I have every reason to believe it is. I didn't see any copies in any stores, but I have to take their word for it. Hutchings and Jackson, I believe, is the company responsible for distribution down there. And
in both Australia and New Zealand?
Oh, in both Australia and New Zealand. And I did have a kind of underwater lunch with this emigre Englishman who is from Hutchins, Jackson. And I can't even remember what we talked about much. It was so...
It was underwater.
Yes, I mean, it really felt like it was underwater.
Are they familiar with your stuff in general in that area of the world?
Well, more familiar than they were, I think. I mean, Pan Books, who used to be my English paperback publishers, really did help me out a lot. They were selling Flying for Sunrise, my last novel. And in the course of doing it, that they also let me heap up stacks of Children of Light, so, and usually were helpful in mentioning it. So forth. So, there was a lot of print journalism about me and the book. Of course, a lot of the questions I got, especially in New Zealand, to a lesser extent in Australia, but certainly in both places, were political, And, of course, I don't know any more than anybody else about what's going to happen next in Central America. I try and stay up with it, but I'm, you know, I get questions put to me as though I had written sometimes, as though I were an authority on Central America, which I'm not.
Well, that's kind of an interesting thing to say. I was talking to somebody, an old friend, hadn't talked to for many years, she on the phone the other day, and she said, "Boy, you've been in broadcast journalism for so many years, I bet, and you work with it every day, I bet you really have an insight about what's going on in the world." And I was thinking about that, and after she said that, and I reached the conclusion that I don't have any more insight than anybody who watches the New York Times, reads Time magazine, watches the CBS Evening News with Dan Rather, and Nightline on ABC has. I might have an insight in terms of watching the publishing industry and some knowledge of literature and things like that, a personal interest of mine, but I think all of us are caught up in the same way you are, unless there is a very specific expertise in a given subject. I guess we're all generalists.
I think so. I mean, generally, I mean, I it's very hard to find anybody who knows what's going on. The people who know aren't saying, you know, as the proverb goes. The people who are saying don't know.
It would be very interesting to me to find out how people, say, in England view your work, because you have a very distinctive American voice. There's a kind of a hard edge to it and to the characters who are not like English people at all. And how do you go over there?
I don't go over terribly well in England, although I have a couple of friends of mine are critics. I had two at once at one point, and the only English critic who has followed my work particularly is Al Alvarez, which is very good because Alvarez is an excellent critic. He seems a little less happy with this particular book than with my earlier work, but I mean, he has a sense of I respect his opinion. He seems to have a sense of what I'm trying to do, and that makes me feel good. But I don't think it's ever been a major, any of my books have made a major impact in England. For one thing, there's a tendency to be dismissive of American prose. Period in England. The super bestsellers here tend to be super bestsellers there. But somebody in my position, you know, as a writer who is for the most part not a mass market writer, I become sort of meat for the critics. The big guys, like Jean Owl and so forth, who is probably going to be a bestseller all over the world with her books. She's in Australia, for example. She's on the bestseller list in Australia and New Zealand. She's probably on the bestseller list in England too. She's undoubtedly done a little promotion. Critics aren't terribly important to her, and the critics don't pay her much attention. They pay a little attention to me, the English critics, usually, except in the case of Al Alvarez and Jeremy Brooks and a couple of other critics, to say this, here's another stew of the American melange, more of this American misery and violence and so forth that we don't want any part of. So, you know, who needs it? Let them keep it over there. I have sold better in other European countries than I have in England.
If what you say is true, that the Brits put down American prose as such, that's a mistake on their part, because there is not very much good English prose being written that I have seen.
Well, I agree. I mean, I think that there are a couple of good novelists and poets. A
couple. I mean, there may be six. Five, yeah. But maybe it's just because we're a bigger country that we have so many more better writers than they have.
We
overwhelm them in terms of better writers. There's no question in my mind. I've been following the literary scene for many years, and I do a lot of English writers. So that is a very unfair and imperceptive criticism, if that's what you say is true.
Well, I think it's true. It's the impression I get. I mean, I think they tend to be dismissive of American novels. Out of hand. Sometimes I get the feeling they haven't even given them much of a chance. that sometimes you get the feeling they're reacting to the blurbs.
Well, about the same talking, do you read Paul Theroux? He wrote a very interesting book that is worth, if you're interested in English at all, called The Kingdom by the Sea. It's in a paperback now, and in it he really takes the English apart. Now, the English as opposed to the Scots and the Irish. But he says they characterize Americans in a very crude way. English are very tight-knit anyway, and so when a stranger comes, they're a little aloof and removed. So they have a stereotypical American there that they laugh at. They imitate our accent, or what they think is our accent, and so they make fun of us a lot. So it doesn't surprise me that this would extend to a feeling of superiority that they might have in terms of literature.
Sure. Well, they have a stereotype to everything. I mean, when it comes to foreigners, I mean, they tend to deal in stereotypes. I mean, this may be universal in Europe. It may not be distinctly English. They certainly have a stereotyped American, and they are confused, and some confused at least, and then sometimes undergo emotions stronger than confusion when an individual American doesn't conform to the stereotype. They get very confused and they don't know what to do or say. I mean, if you give them back the kind of invisible torpedo, faint but ambiguous put down, they really can't handle it because they don't expect it from an American, because according to their theory, Americans don't even know about this. You're supposed to be able to sit down and insult an American for half an hour, and he doesn't know he's being insulted. That's the stereotype.
You lived in
four years.
Yeah. What was that like?
It was very pleasant. It was so pleasant that I was having trouble getting any work done. I found it, very congenial, very comfortable.
You made friends with the
English? Yeah, I made some very close friends.
Who did not put you down?
Who did not put me down? Well, I mean, because who finally got to know me as a person rather than... I mean, you've got to overcome that. They're not seeing a person, they're seeing an American for a while. And all Americans are alike, as far as they're concerned. And even if you don't speak with the stereotypical accent, they hear you, and they hear you speaking that way. Even if you don't have it, they're hearing it.
Well, Robert Stoner, I'm not going to get all my questions in unless we start. I want to go back and ask you some questions about yourself, because I don't think a radio audience has heard much of you, if at all, at least not mine. So I'd like to find out a little bit about your background and then work into some questions I have about your work and Children of Light. Now, I understand that you were in a Catholic orphanage from the age of 6 to 10. This must have been a very traumatic experience as a child. How has this affected you as a writer?
I think in a way it was the making of me as a writer. Certainly it was traumatic. I don't remember it as particularly unpleasant, but of course memory is selective. I do remember the wrenching of being in a totally new situation at a fairly early age, and I remember the proximity, the close proximity of other people, and experiencing the necessity of dealing and finding out that people had to be dealt with in different ways. I mean, it was institutional living. And
was that here in New York City?
That was in New York, yeah.
Manhattan.
Mm-hmm. And it was, in a way, it was related to all other institutional living, from the armed services to from the boarding school to the armed services to the penitentiary. The same kind of politics, the same kind of simian politics takes place in environments where people are thrown together to kind of make it or not. I mean, I don't think that this was, I don't think the Marist brothers were particularly remiss in their, in their attempts to provide guidance and custody for these little kids I was in with, but I think their ideas in the 1950s, in the late 1940s and early 50s, were often misguided. I mean, they used to hit you a lot. But the necessity of coping with that situation, with my situation at home, created in me, I think, the ability to react, or if not to react fast, at least to think about what I was doing and to think about what other people were like, and it made me imagine my way into other people's situation. I think if you have to deal with a lot of people very early on, you're compelled to make the act of imagination to feel how it is with them, because they are the people that you have to deal. You have to say to yourself, what would I do if I were so-and-so who I have to deal with? And so it gives you a certain empathy. You get to be able to imagine yourself into many people's situation. So I think in that way it was a positive experience for me. It wasn't pleasant, but it didn't destroy me either.
In some of the publicity material the publisher sent over, stated that your mother had emotional problems, which led to your going to the orphanage, but she improved enough to go back to her after in your 10th year.
Yeah.
What was that? What was that like?
Well, I had seen her on and off. I mean, she was visitable sometimes. I was visitable sometimes. We had spent the odd weekend together. I went into a school run by the Marist Brothers. I had sort of imprinted them or whatever. It was physically living with my mother. Well, it was we were in a series of boarding houses, rooming houses, what are now called SROs. In those days, they were a lot less dangerous and violent than today. They had a wide sampling of people rather than, you know, the rather limited sampling of people that they seem to have today.
Yeah, the old time West Side residential hotel.
Exactly. With the Hotel Baltimore sort of thing, with everybody slightly on the skids, slightly seedy, maintaining an appearance. People who wore their rubbers a lot because they had holes in their shoes. People of that sort.
Is your mother still alive?
My mother died many years ago, 1971.
Now, in Children of Light, Luann, of course, is a schizophrenic, and your mother apparently had the same symptoms. Did you draw on this experience to create Luann?
Yes. I mean, partly drew on the experience as I had perceived it from the outside, and again, I was compelled, in my mother's situation, to imagine myself into her perception. It was necessary if I was going to be able to tell what was real from what wasn't. So, yes, I did the answer. I guess the short answer is yes, I did.
You went into the Navy at a very young age. Was this a good experience, an improvement in your life?
Yes, I do. I think it was definitely an improvement. There was really I hadn't finished high school. I really couldn't get a job worth very much. I wandered around for a while, and then I thought, well, there was the draft in those days, and the military obligation had to be faced. So I thought, well, I'm not really doing anything else, so I guess I'll go in. And I went in before I was 18, as a result of which I served what was called a minority enlistment, or kiddie cruise. I got out when I was 21. And
You were in 4 years then, huh?
I was in something less than 4 years, I enjoyed it very much, thinking back on it now. I mean, I don't think I enjoyed it at the time.
That must have been a period of maturation. Yeah, those are very formative years.
Yeah, well, it was a period of maturation. I mean, I really was a kid when I went in. And I was grown up when I got out, even though, we had no experience of war. In the Navy in those years.
Did you go around the world?
We literally went around the world in Operation Deep Freeze 3. We We went to the Antarctic, and we went down via the Panama.
What kind of ship were you on?
That was an AKA. It was the USS Mullifon. I think it was AKA 51, an attack transport. Very much like the ships that carried the barges that landed materiel at Normandy and Okinawa. Big A-frames, fore and aft.
You had such a confused childhood, and here's this confused adolescence or post-adolescence. Had any point during this period, had it entered your mind that you wanted to write or put words down on paper?
Well, my sense of my way of making sense of things was by turning them into narrative. I mean, the first, I think, major thought that ever occurred to me was something along the lines of, my God, I am just out here in this stuff, this phenomenology, whatever it is. And when I was a child and until adolescence, I think religion sufficed as an answer to that quandary of being just out there. And when I left religion, I thought, that I left it with a great deal of feeling of liberation and so forth, and it was only much later that it began to come back to me that I had lost something significant. As to think whether I could be a writer or not, I think I wanted to be fairly early on, certainly by the time I was in the Navy. I had many doubts as to whether I ever could be. That didn't seem to be the kind of thing that I was likely to get to do. I mean, I wasn't sure what I was going to do, but I certainly didn't in any way count on being a professional writer, although I think I was beginning to have hopes.
Were you keeping notes or journal?
No, I never wrote anything when I was in the Navy. I had written in school, in high school, and I'd had some. That was the only positive feedback I ever got in school.
You still haven't written about the Navy, have you?
Never, no. And I don't think I will, partly because I don't see anything there. I might, one day something might occur to me, a story or something, but I don't see anything in my Navy years really to write about. In other words, that concerns me as the kind of writer I am. I mean, there are lots of things that a writer with a different perspective, might find useful from a term of military service like mine. But I don't have any literary use for my Navy years. I think they were pleasant enough and interesting. But I'm not going to turn them into fiction, I don't think.
You said something interesting a moment ago. You said, when I left religion. What does that mean? I mean, how does one leave religion?
Well, I guess if you're a Catholic, you stop going to church. I saw that as leaving religion. That's what that meant to me. But, of course, religion doesn't get left that easily. I see I think my impulses are primarily religious. In fact, it's very difficult for somebody like me to function outside of a religious context because I'm full of questions.
A religious context, but do you see yourself as an atheist?
I wouldn't say I was an atheist, no. I really don't know whether there's a personal God or not. The question does concern me. I find the apparent absence of God to be a very important element in the modern world. I mean, I was always taken with Heidegger's notion of God's absence as a kind of positive dynamic. So the absence.
Interestingly, in Children of Light, Gordon Walker at the end has reformed. He's no longer drinking. He's taking medicine for his high blood pressure, and I can't remember the girl's name. Shelley, I think.
Shelley.
Dumps a glass of water on his lap. And this, in effect, is the end of the novel. And yet, it is kind of supposed to be a new beginning for Gordon. And yet, he seems to be no happier than he was at the beginning of the book. And I just wonder if this means in reality, there is no beginning, a new beginning.
Oh, I think what he is repentant, because both he knows and Shelley knows that his irresponsibility and his illusion, his drug-nurtured illusions, caused a catastrophe. And he knows that. He knows that what his illusions and drug-taking caused. And Shelley knows it. And they both know. They both know it. And that's what's going on, really, in that scene. He's going to get it together, perhaps. Perhaps not. I'm not really sure whether he's going to succeed. But I am sure of one thing, that he knows now exactly what he did and how it happened. And if he had regrets before, he has them still. He allowed himself to be illusioned by drugs and alcohol, and as a result, he set about a chain of circumstances that ended in disaster. And he knows that he has no one but himself to blame, and Shelley also knows it, which is why she dumps the water on him and talks to him the way she does.
I guess this was my own faulty analysis, but it still may be accurate. I guess it maybe has nothing to do with Gordon per se, except to indicate a feeling that sometimes when you start a new beginning, in a way there are no new starts. I don't know if you can ever start fresh. I'm not sure Gordon, because of the enormity of his acts and what happened, would ever be able to start fresh. You said he was depressed, but even though he has changed his attitude towards substances, I'm not sure his feelings are that much. He's back with his wife, I understand, and has moved to the East Coast, but still not sure he's gone that much further ahead.
Well, I'm not sure either. I mean, I'm not offering a reformed Gordon Walker or a new start there. I do try to convey that he knows what he's done, because one of the only things that makes Walker at all sympathetic is perception. I mean, it is because of his perception and his ability to understand what's going on around him that he becomes sympathetic at all. So what I'm trying to dramatize in that last scene is his awareness of what he's caused to happen. Doesn't mean he won't do it again. It doesn't mean that he's getting a new start, because, as you say, how often have you seen anybody get a real new start in life? It's not something that happens in life, though it may happen in fiction. It doesn't happen in life very often. So I'm not presuming to say this is a man who has learned his lesson and will clean up his act. I'm just saying this is a man who knows what he's done.
You, of course, wrote the screenplays for Hall of Mirrors and Dog Soldiers. So apparently, I don't know, I just am guessing that your exposure to the Hollywood types came through that experience. Is that true?
Well, partly through working on those pictures, certainly. I got to know about the movie business.
Well, are the movie people in this little village on the Mexican coast, are they really as vile and nasty and rotten as you pictured them to be? That party toward the end there where the New York writer takes a swing at Gordon, for example, and everybody's talking, it's almost... it's almost surreal. I'm not following what everybody is saying, but everybody is insulting each other, and everybody has double meanings to what he's saying. And is life really like that among those film people?
Sometimes it is. I don't think there's anything in that book that doesn't connect with something that actually happened. Now, consider, for example, what would the narrative of John Belushi's Last Night read like? I mean, if the question is, you know, do people really behave in this incredibly self-destructive way and destroy themselves and people around them, consider that. I mean, I'm sure that a narrative of John Belushi's Last Night would be a lot more discomforting than the party scene in Children of Light. Everything in that book connects, not with something I may have witnessed, but with something that happened in the movie business at some time in the long history of the movies.
Children of Light, I assume that comes from the title of a Robert Lowell poem. Robert Lowell poem that I never did understand. Never quite certain what he meant by that. But tell me a little bit about how you derived the title from this poem and what influence this poem had on the title, or is it just a coincidence?
Well, I used that that very poem, Children of Light, for the epigraph for my first book.
A Hall of Mirrors.
Yes, right. Well, the reason I may be even a little slow with the title is I was sort of talked into changing the title, and
I'm sorry. That's
was never altogether pleased with the Hall of Mirrors. The poem was.
I imagine you're less pleased with WUSA.
Yes, I was.
In more ways than one.
I don't know how they can do that. I mean, I have this conversation with the people who are about to change my title, in which I point out to them that they have just hired me for a great deal of money to write for them, and if they think they can do it better than me, why don't they do it themselves? But this does not seem to stop them from giving absurd and meaningless titles to film versions of my books. But to respond to your question about Children of Light, I think the text is, I think Robert Lowell took his text from First Thessalonians, which I will have to leave you to refer to. To me, the poem, the Robert Lowell poem, has to do with the underlying guilt, both spiritual and literal, of America. I mean, it's a poem in a way. It's a discourse on Calvinism. That the poem "Children of Light." Our fathers wrung their bread from stocks and stones and fenced their gardens with the red man's bones. Embarking from the Netherland of Holland. Pilgrims unhouseled by Geneva's night, you planted here the serpent's seeds of light. And here the pivoting searchlights probe to shock the riotous glass houses built on rock, and candles gutter in a hall of mirrors, and light is where the ancient blood of Cain is burning, burning the unburied grain. So I take that to refer not only to the Puritan sense of sin as something underlying man's condition, that man is born in depravity, and that even the Second Jerusalem, the settlement in America, is on some level in depravity, but also the literal guilt is referred to, the fencing of gardens with the red man's bones. That in a way explains both titles. I had wanted to call the first one Hall of Mirrors. I had wanted to call that Children of Light. I'd wanted to call A Hall of Mirrors Children of Light. It was a title I really wanted to use, and I found it. I found the biblical text applicable. As I say, I'm going to have to leave you to look up the text.
Well, that poem has been in your mind for many years, hasn't it?
Yeah.
Lowell does that to you. There are some poems of Lowell that I have not understood well. I have all of his stuff, and I read it. There are some poems that I've read, usually after having a couple of martinis, and I can sit there and I become very maudlin, because there are things that just I will look at four or five times and they begin to ooze into my bloodstream somehow. He doesn't slap you in the face with a poem. That's one that you grow into as poems,
right,
I
right.
think. You mentioned the titles a while ago. Dog Soldiers won the National Book Award, and everybody was a highly praised book, and yet they changed the title of the movie, which I thought was a very good movie, called Who Will Stop the Rain? Now, what was the purpose of it? Why didn't they capitalize on the publicity for Dog Soldiers?
Well, as I understand it, and this I can hardly find this credible, but it's the only explanation I have, and it came to me secondhand, but the reason, according to what I have been told, is that the decision was taken from UA by Transamerica, the people in the pyramid, who thought they had enough of Hollywood zanies giving non-commercial titles to films. So they decided that they would name it on the basis of their market research. And their market research, according to the story I was told, led them to the conclusion that women, particularly in the Southwest, had an aversion to dogs and soldiers. Now, that is not my experience. I find generally in life that women rather like dogs and soldiers, even in the Southwestern United States, perhaps more in the Southwestern United States than elsewhere. But the decision was made by the people in the pyramid, and there was nothing we could do about it.
Dumb, dumb, dumb. You know, the book can, in effect, feed on the novel, on the movie, and the movie can feed on the book, and there's an interrelationship that goes on and on and on. There are going to be people who will turn on television late at night sometime and watch Who Will Stop the Rain and have no idea that it was dog soldiers. Whereas, if it had been dog soldiers, they might say, hey, I want to read that, and they might go out and buy the book. So it just strikes me as one of the dumbest things. And by the same token, somebody is going to pick up a reprint of Dog Soldiers and not have any idea that the movie was of that book.
So everybody loses.
I think so. Well, that's my own opinion. I've been fuming about that for a long time. There was another thing. We're almost out of time, but we were out of time a long time ago, but I have to ask you this. I was not aware that there was a real, honest-to-goodness book by Kate Chopin.
Chopin, yeah. She was married to a Frenchman in Louisiana, so it would be Chopin.
1899, called The Awakening. How did you come across that novel and use that as kind of a bed for Children of Light?
I came across it in the library of Amherst College in Amherst, Massachusetts. I don't believe I had heard anything about it, although at the same time it was being discovered principally by feminists as a proto-feminist novel. But my office, the office I was working in, rather, because I had a borrowed office, was near the American literature section. And whether it was in a book of criticism or whether, though that I saw it referred to, it may have been in a literary history of the time that I saw it first referred to. And because it was New Orleans and things about New Orleans interest me, or for whatever reason, I took it down and read it, and I thought, this isn't half bad. In fact, it's rather good. In fact, it would make a kind of interesting movie of a certain sort. Like the Bostonians, for example. It doesn't have a lot of high drama until the very end, but it would have been, I thought, a good film. So when I wanted to write a book about the making of a film and create that act, the character of that schizophrenic actress, it seemed to me ideal that the film they'd be making be a film version of this Louisiana woman's novel. A novel, not to call it a woman's novel, capital W, capital N, because it's not that. It's more than that. It's simply a novel by a Louisiana woman.
What is it, kind of a cult favorite now?
It began among feminists, and there's no reason to. It's restricted to feminists. It's quite a good novel. It has certain affinities with Madame Bovary, but it has probably more affinities with the naturalists, Frank Norris and
Upton Sinclair.
Frank Norris, Upton Sinclair, Stephen Crane.
Yeah, I know that group.
Yeah.
Well, you certainly, Robert Stone, became respectable after your beatnik days and your drug experimental days. You taught in Ivy League schools like Princeton and Harvard, and you won the National Book Award and all sorts of other honors and praise. Why is it that we have to wait so long to have books from you, like years in between books?
Well, I'm going to try and speed up production a little bit. I know biblical cycles between books don't make it. So I intend now to work harder. I should be at this point in my life ready to work and do not nearly so much else, and that is in fact my intention.
Are you staying away from the psychedelics?
I haven't been anywhere near psychedelics in well over 15 or 16 years, and I think psychedelics are a very powerful and dangerous entity, and I'm not really sure that I got anything out of them except the creeps.
Are you basing yourself in the East Coast on a permanent basis now?
I think so, yeah. I mean, I do a lot of teaching, and I may teach somewhere else in the future, but I think I will be based here.
Teaching's probably good in many respects, too, because it gets you out of the house. You
know? Yes, it puts a structure to your day, and it also makes you think about what your opinions are about literature. I mean, you get a bunch of smart undergraduates or graduates, and you have got to explain your terms. You can't just fuzzily ramble on about the principles of good writing. You have to be as specific as it's possible to be.
One thing in each of your books, each one is different. When you referred to a friend of yours who is also a critic in England, and he said he didn't care for Children of Light as much as he has other works, I can understand that. But because each work is so much different from each other, it's sometimes difficult to compare one directly with the other.
Well,
in a way, that's kind of an unfair criticism. So I didn't like it as well as, and that may be true. Maybe he didn't like it as well, but I don't know if that matters.
It doesn't mean it's not as good. Right. No, I think it's really a writer's responsibility to get out of familiar areas. Otherwise, I think the path towards self-indulgence lies. When you keep doing the same numbers over and over again, it's a little bit like an actor who keeps the mannerisms that they think they look cute with. No, I think you've got to move. You can't stay in the same place. You've got to keep thinking. I mean, I'm going to keep thinking about what the world is like and how it is, and I'm going to react to it in different ways. I don't think I'm going to react to it always in the same way from the same place, because my life is changing. I'm getting older. Lots of things are changing. The world is changing and I'm changing. So I'm going to try and keep my options open in terms of my reaction.
Thank goodness for that. Robert Stone, a 30-minute interview stretched on to an hour.